Hi, I'm Eileen Forrestal, and you're listening to the Breffni Early Show.
Breffni, you come all the way from Ireland for this adventure.
Isn't Breffni Early a real tonic, full of positivity?
It's an amazing story, Breffni, with a wonderful, happy ending.
All of those things on your bucket list wouldn't necessarily have led you to do the World Cycle Race.
27 countries, 490 days. 18,000 miles on a bike.
You've decided that's it. You're going to keep giving yourself challenges.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Breffni Early Show, where each week we bring you a special guest, someone who's interesting, inspirational, and motivational. And I think you're going to enjoy this week's guest. Her name is Eileen Forrestal. Eileen, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Breffni. I'm delighted to be here.
We're going to be talking about your adventures over the last 6 or 7 years, particularly as part of this week's show. And the Get Up and Go diary and Get Up and Go publications is going to feature quite heavily in that. It's your own company you've set up with your partner, Brendan. And we're going to be talking about that a little bit later on in the show. But first, I want to talk a little bit about Eileen Forrestal and a little bit about yourself. You're a doctor by profession. Why do you end up working in a publishing house?
Right, well that's an interesting question. Yes, I am a doctor by profession. I qualified in 1982 from UCD, and I spent the last 32 years as practicing as a doctor. I've been through practically all the specialties, but I actually settled on anaesthesia for the last 20 years. But before that, I'd actually been through general practice and psychiatry and accident and emergency and obstetrics and all of it, and I absolutely loved it. And you're right to say, I'm now in the world of publishing. So a year ago, I did actually retire. I had worked in Sligo General for the last 18 years, loved it, and just saw an opportunity now where I just wanted to do something probably that I always wanted to do, but maybe didn't have the courage. And now, you know, when am I going to do it? So I'm doing it now.
I'm sure there's a lot of people in the world of publishing who would be more than happy to move into the world of medicine, primarily for the financial rewards that it brings in some respects. I presume it's the opposite going the other way. It's more graft, more grind, on a day-to-day basis. It's completely different from the world of medicine.
It's completely different. It's neither graft nor grind, I'm afraid, Breffni. It's just something I love doing. It's actually me. And when you say, you know, financially in the world of medicine, it's like, yes, I did have all of the financial trappings of success. However, I never went into medicine for the money in the first place. I was almost a little bit embarrassed about the money that I had. I sort of spent it kind of quickly to get rid of it because I wasn't really quite sure.
I'm sure if you've too much, we can find some listeners who'd be more than happy. Do they send their letters of application?
Well, to be honest, I don't actually have it anymore. But, you know, over my years, I did certainly, you know, I did have a very successful career. But, you know, if you want to even maybe think why I went into medicine in the first place, probably because of, number one, my dad would have always said, your health is your wealth. And he had been really sick when he was young, and he had TB, and he was in hospital for 3 years. And he never thought he was going to leave hospital because most of his friends, as he said, they left in a box. So when he was about 33, the first streptomycin trials came about, and he volunteered for a trial. So he was successful, and he left hospital a well man. Now, fortunately, my mother had been a nurse while he was in hospital, and they met a little while later, getting on and off a bus.
Is that ethical?
And it was quite a bit like, you know, quite a long time later, or not, okay. Maybe not that long, but certainly, and they met, and then that's the rest is history. So I suppose in a way I owed a lot to, you know, Dad had a great time for the health service and health care and what it had provided for him for his life. And he was so, just so happy and so grateful to be alive that, you know, money was never really a conversation. It was more about health and about being happy. And just, you know, we weren't very wealthy when we grew up. We grew up in a very standard house. My dad worked in insurance, and that was, you know, and I suppose all he really wanted us to do was just to be independent and just enjoy life. So, you know, I was clever, and maybe, you know, I think I used to watch Marcus Welby, MD. It'll tell you how old I am.
I have no idea who or what that is.
Maybe
I'm presuming
ask your mother.
It's a TV show.
Maybe ask your mother. It was about Marcus Welby. It was about a GP. And he was just a really, really, I suppose, just a really caring, kind man. And I just thought that actually was, you know, something that I just kind of thought maybe I'll fit in there. So that's really what I did. And really over my career, that was really what I attempted, was just that. And obviously the money came as a byproduct, but it was really never it. So when I got the opportunity then, as I say, to move and to get into publishing, which I'm sure you're going to talk about in a moment, that was really where this kind of, real kind of, purpose, what really was I wanted to do with my life. So I couldn't save everybody with my two bare hands, you know. It was like there was only so much you could do when you're working that way. So I wanted to kind of use my voice or words or something to kind of get the message maybe out a little bit, that certainly health is wealth.
You're one of the most positive people that I know. And you're just being in your company for a few minutes or a few hours, you just bring that positivity to the conversation. And that's probably the nucleus of why you got involved and why you set up the Get Up and Go diary. Tell me a bit about the origins of the diary first.
Okay, well, you know, like anybody else, I'm not always positive. You know, stuff happens in life. And I did have a difficult time. At one stage I was going through, I'm actually divorced, so I was actually going through a separation issue. And I actually used to use a little diary called the Irish Survivor's Diary. And it was a very simple little diary, and I would just use it and I'd read it every day. There was a little message in it. And that little message just encouraged me just to deal with whatever I had to deal with. And anyway, fast forward a couple of years, and I was doing some fundraising. And I was doing a cycle from, in Vietnam, I was doing a cycle from Saigon to Angkor Wat. I was raising funds for ActionAid for Cambodia. I have a little NGO there. And I was really, befuddled as to what ideas for fundraising. It was never, fundraising, I don't know. But anyway, I was flicking through my little Irish Survivor's diary that I used to buy every year. And I just looked at the diary and I thought, wait a minute, maybe the person who does this diary would actually give me some of the funds of the Christmas proceeds for my fundraising. So I thought, oh, there's a good idea. It won't be much, but it'll be something. So I went back to the shop where I bought the diary, and they said, oh, that's a woman, Glenda Devlin. She lives in Sligo, in Strandhill. And I thought, really? Well, that's kind of interesting. So I went out to Strandhill. I knocked on her door and I introduced myself and I said what I was doing, and I was hoping that she would give me some of the fundraising or some of the funds, some of the proceeds of her Christmas sales for my fundraising. And Glenda at that time anyway said that she was thinking maybe of not doing the diary anymore, that, she had been doing it by herself and it was a little bit of a struggle or whatever to do it. And she was thinking of not doing it. And I was kind of thinking, oh, no, really, that would be a shame. And then she said, would I be interested in going into a partnership in publishing? And I thought, well, crikey, I'm a doctor. I don't know anything about publishing. But really, it's like, if this is what's going to take to save the diary, then OK, I'll do it. I'll do my best. But I don't want the diary not to actually, because I had actually, I suppose, owed it so much for myself. So, we went into partnership. And maybe for the next, that was in 2007, and I'd say for the next 7 years then, on the next 10 years, sorry, until 2014, I actually worked half-time then. So half-time as an anaesthetist in Sligo, and the other half-time then just in kind of developing the diary. So at that point, it was 2007, so, the economy was doing really well, and I wasn't really that keen, really. I had overcome my difficulties. I was now kind of up and going again, and I wanted to change the name. I wasn't really that interested in just about surviving. I thought there was way more to life than just surviving. And I thought really living and getting up and going was actually would be way more, encouraging for people. So we changed the name of the diary and it became the Get Up and Go Diary. And really, we've been kind of up and going ever since. So, it was just a matter of just really, I put my heart and soul into it. I love it. I love, I source the quotes. We get the images. I put the whole thing together. I love actually creating it. We have a wonderful designer.
Describe the diary to me, because you mentioned the quotes. What's different about the Get Up and Go diary to a bog standard diary you pick up in your local bookshop?
Oh, look, I couldn't really say that. I could, I could describe it, but until you pick it up yourself, you won't really know the difference. But when you pick it up yourself, you think, that's the difference. So, most people, when they look at it and open it, it's quite unexpected. So, maybe people are expecting something that looked like a diary, and this doesn't really look like a diary. So,
but it does look like a diary.
It looks a little bit like a diary.
It's standard, just to give ideas or an idea of what it looks like to people maybe who are listening. It's a standard diary. It's the size of a small book. It's a week planner on a diary for the most part, but there's little inspirational quotes for every day, and then the stories and little pieces of art and little pieces of just randomness, but all packed with little bits of inspiration and bits of motivation the whole way through. It's perfect for the listeners to this podcast, and I know there are some listeners who got this in their Christmas stockings from me at Christmas. So I don't have my copy to hand, but there is one somewhere in the house. I know my sisters and my nephew use it religiously, and the travel diary has definitely got a taster as well this year, just back from India. But the diary itself, let's put it into some numbers for a minute so people can get an idea of where it's come from. So when you got involved in 2006, what was the sales figures? How many did they sell a year, approximately? A ballpark figure will do. Are we talking hundreds, thousands?
I'd say maybe, really, to be quite honest, I don't actually know. But I would say less than 1,000.
Less than 1,000.
Yeah.
And for argument's sake, in 2015, what kind of volume across the entire range of diaries that you do?
I'd say 40,000.
Okay, so we're talking considerable growth.
We are,
through,
yeah.
Through a period that isn't renowned for considerable growth in this country.
No,
so
no.
Maybe that shows that people are actually looking for that little bit of inspiration, that little bit of motivation every day, just when they wake up and they take a little note of what they're doing for the day, they get that little quote. Give us a taster. Today's date is the 23rd of March.
Okay.
Yeah, so what's in our diary for boys?
Okay, the 23rd of March for boys. Don't make up stories.
That's a fantastic one.
What happened, happened.
Brilliant. I love that. And then you've got the adult version there beside you as well, the Get Up and Go diary for Irish adults.
For adults. So the Irish Get Up and Go diary, it says, there is no such thing as a little thing.
Now, you're going to have to explain that one for me. Because that could be taken up so many different ways. But I think that's probably the beauty of it.
Yeah, everything can be taken up lots of different ways. Just like, you know, people think, oh, that was just a little thing. But, you know, a little thing in your eyes could be a big thing in somebody else's eyes. So sometimes when we say little, maybe it belittles something. And, you know, you might think that, you know, an ant is a little thing. But really, for an ant, it's its whole life. So when you trot on an ant, that's a little thing, is no longer on the planet. So I think things are things. And when we say they're little, it's like we pass some sort of description on them that may actually not be entirely true.
Get Up and Go Events is a new project you started last year. You had a fantastic day in Sligo. In 2014 was the first year. My first awareness of it was last year when you very kindly invited me to speak at the event. Where did the genesis for that come from?
Oh, well, a little bit like, you know, okay, we say the diary. So we say the diary inspires and motivates. That's what the diary does. But I actually think that it's people that inspire and motivate, because the diaries are all full of quotes, but people actually said what they said. So it's people that inspire people. So, you know, whether you've written a book that inspires people or you've said something that inspired people, it's actually been somebody has spoken some words. So in my sort of life, I've met lots of people who have inspired me. They've not inspired me by just sitting there and gazing off into the sunset. They've inspired me because of something that they have said. They've either told me something that they've done that I thought's been pretty amazing, or, you know, they're just saying something. So for me, it's people. So people who have done things, who are willing to talk about them. And to me, they've been pretty inspiring. So Brefni, yes, as you say, I thought what you did was pretty inspiring. I thought that was pretty amazing. And I thought definitely that is somebody that's definitely getting up and going in life. And, you know, has actually gone around the world. He's cycled. He's put himself out there, you know, under pretty, you know, I'm sure, trying circumstances as you go around the world. It's not an easy planet to navigate, I'm sure, on a bicycle.
There are certain dodgy parts.
I'm sure there's certain dodgy parts. And so just well done to you. And I just thought, really, that's the kind of message that I want people to hear, that actually you do actually have to get up and go and do something and then tell people what you did. And if you're proud of it, tell them what you did. And then maybe other people then get a courage or a confidence or something that they can go and do something similar. They don't have to cycle around the world, but maybe there is something that they could do. And it can be, you know, something big or something small, but you do actually have to go and do something. And I think that's just where the events came from. So the first year we had Pat Falvey, And he's just a really, you know, for an Irish inspirational person, you know, he's been up to like Everest so many times. He's crossed the North Pole, the South Pole. And he's just saying, I mean, you know, we really are of unlimited potential. There is nothing stopping anybody. If it's possible for one human being on the planet to do it, it's possible for all of us. Whether we want to do it or not, that's entirely our business. But it's not that we physically, you know, if we're an able-bodied person, it's physically we can do what every other physical able-bodied person can do.
And even if you're not physically able.
If you're not physically, you can do what
is still absolutely adaptable.
Absolutely. Everybody can do what they're physically capable of doing. That's it. Not everybody might have the same. I don't have the same physical capabilities as you do. You're a much bigger, stronger person than I am. So I can't lift what you can lift. I can't push what you can push, but I can do what I can do.
You could probably cycle around the world.
So I can probably cycle around the world. Well, I cycled, as I said, I cycled 350 kilometers from Saigon to Angkor Wat. It was a magical, magical, magical journey. And the one beauty about it was that it was the Mekong Delta and it was flat entirely.
You'd be amazed how much of the world is pretty flat. Like Ireland, as far as Ireland goes, Ireland was probably one of the hillier places to cycle. Like India, apart from the mountains, which obviously aren't flat, but
yes,
the two coasts of India,
yes,
were pretty much flat.
Yeah.
Australia is pretty flat, apart from a couple of hills outside of Sydney and a couple of hills outside of Adelaide. Like, I think we, yeah, could be onto something here.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a bit like life. Most of life is actually flat. Most of life is actually flat, and every so often we meet a hill. Sometimes we meet a mountain. And really, it depends on how we tackle it. And, you know, sometimes it's easier on a bicycle, but sometimes it's easier off a bicycle.
At my size, it's never easy on a bicycle going uphill, trust me.
Well, yeah.
Will we be having a repeat of Get Up and Go this year?
Well, the plan is, yes, the plan is definitely to repeat it. And I already have a list of names of people that I'm starting to invite. And so, yeah, watch this space.
Okay. We'll come back to you on that later in the year. What possesses somebody in your position to give up your day job and jump into publishing?
For most things, it's a kind of a when. You know, if I want to do something, it's like, when am I going to do it? So I had thought for, you know, quite a number of years, when will I do it? When will I do it? When will I do it? And I suppose the opportunity came for early retirement. Now, I had to look and see whether I could afford early retirement because I hadn't planned on early retirement. So in order to find out whether I could afford it, I had to take a serious look at my finances. So I did have to get somebody to help me and actually go through, because I'm not a financial person, as you can tell. So I did have to get somebody and work closely with them and say, could I, with a lot of, you know, kind of maybe restrictions, a little bit of my lifestyle, but could I do it? And did I actually want to do it? And, you know, like I said, I spent 32 years in medicine and I kind of felt I nearly had come to the limit of what I could contribute. Now, I'm still young, I'm still healthy, I'm still fit, and there is so much more that I want to do. So is it now or will it be later? So there's no such thing as later. It's always now. So when I said now, it's like, OK, now I'm going to do it. And then when it was the time, I said, OK, now I'm going to do it. So now I did it. So now it's done.
Do you regret that?
Not for one moment. Not for one moment. I've just, it's been, I suppose it's been an amazing freedom.
Who of the people that you've come in contact with through the diary and through the events would be the three people that you would like to spend an evening with? Over drinks or dinner, who inspires you or who motivates you?
Other than
myself, of course.
Other than yourself, preferably. Okay. Well, gosh, you know, most people, actually, I find something pretty much amazing about most people, to be quite honest. I'm not sort of taken away from, but most people have done an awful lot of things. Most people have done so much in their lives that we don't know about. And sometimes when you sit and you speak to people and you realize what they've come through and what they've overcome and you actually sit and listen to them, it's really quite amazing. So people are inclined not to talk so much about themselves and what maybe they've done and what they've achieved and what they've accomplished.
Irish people,
yeah.
Not so much in other nationalities.
Maybe not so much in other nationalities. So I think Irish people are inclined to hide a little bit and not, you know, not kind of, you know, I think there's been amazing, extraordinary people in this country. You know, right here we are in 1916 and we're celebrating an Easter rising, you know, and really the Irish people, you know, really did actually rise up. You know, and
now, I'm glad you brought this up because we're recording this a little bit ahead of the release date. So we're a week early. And today at 12 o'clock, today is actually, we said the 23rd of March earlier, it's been put out on the 23rd of March. Today is actually the 15th of March. Today was Proclamation Day, so all the schools shut down at 12 o'clock and they raised the Irish flag and they read the proclamation. What's your take on that? Because I drove past a school today and I thought for one second, are we actually glamorising violence here? Because the whole 2016, 100 year anniversary of 1916, I just kind of at times think, is that something we should really be? It wasn't our independence. Our independence isn't, the centenary is not for another 5 or 6 years. Should we be glamorising going out and killing people, and even if it was in the name of freedom? Is that something we should be doing, in your opinion?
Well, certainly, I don't think ever we should glamorise violence or endorse violence or anything like that. However, I don't necessarily see 1916 as... Obviously, there was violence involved, but to me, I suppose I look for what was behind the violence, because violence is almost always a last resort. And, you know, I think behind that was a desperate desire for, I suppose, self-determination in the country. There was a desire for freedom. There was a desire for Irish people to be governing Ireland, to be for, you know, Irish people just to be showing up as Irish people in the world, and not to be oppressed or feel that they were, you know, that their rights were being compromised or whatever. So it's behind that. I'm sure nobody resorts to violence until it's a last resort. And, you know, we can look around the world today and there's violence absolutely everywhere. And at the end, when enough bloodshed has been, enough blood has been spilled, people will say, okay, now I surrender. And then they start talking. And I think, crikey, couldn't people just start talking earlier? Without having to, like, the cost of violence. So, yes, you know, I think violence, I'm not going to say it's necessary. Personally, I don't think it's necessary. I think it's, as I say, it's a last resort when it really looks like that people are not listening to what the other person is trying to say. And if we listened a little bit closer, most people want the freedom. Most people want to be respected, to be acknowledged. They want a dignity. They want to be able to determine their own lives and not to be, you know, controlled or whatever. So, you know, I think if we can listen to people, then maybe people don't have to resort to violence. But, you know, it's a complicated issue. People have been violent forever. It's part of the human condition, is that we can, you know, lash out, either violence with your, you know, people are violent with their actions, they're violent in their, violent with their words. And but words, you know, sticks and stones will break my bones, but, you know, names will actually never hurt me. And
that was a huge tangent off on my original question, which is who would you have over for dinner? And you can't tell me everybody. I need three names. The people you've come in touch with, you can give me more than three names. But who are the people who you have sat in a room and listened to speak, or you've seen on media, be it radio or television, and you've heard them and said, oh my God, that person is absolutely amazing?
Okay, well, the first person that actually was our first guest at the first event that we had in 2014 was actually Glenda's father, Frikkie van Kruijenberg, who's a South African gentleman.
Oh, pardon, what was his name?
His name was Frikkie van Kruijenberg. Glenda Frikkie is originally from South Africa. Yeah. So her father was an absolutely amazing man. And he actually opened the first event that we had. And just to sit in a room with him is an unbelievable experience, just to see what he has accumulated and what he is, just really what he has done over the course of his life is just phenomenal. So, as I say, it's the origin of the diary. It is Glenda's dad. So I'm not surprised that there is some of his wisdom and some of what he has gleaned through. Really, you know, a lot of it, you know, we quote Napoleon Hill. I'm sure you've heard of Napoleon Hill. Yeah. And Frikkie, when he was 19, actually read the book Think and Grow Rich. And then he actually left South Africa at 19 to go and find Napoleon Hill, to go and talk to Napoleon Hill and listen and think, where did he get the ideas that, you know, how thoughts were so powerful and thoughts become things. So that was the start of his journey. And then he's still journeying. He's 86 and he is still on that journey. It's just a phenomenal person to listen to. So he's amazing. Well, the other person I'd like to spend an evening with would be Aung San Suu Kyi. And I believe that the elections in Burma, that a childhood friend of hers has now been elected president, because she's actually not allowed to be president.
Why is she not allowed?
I don't know, actually. I really don't know the ins and outs of it. I think there's something.
A convict of some sort.
Something like that. So when she came to Ireland, I actually did come and listen to her. She spoke at the Bord Gáis. And she was invited, I think, by Bono at that, I forget what year it was.
I did actually go up
and I listened to her. And really, again, an amazing voice. She just, you know, really the stand that she is for her people and that they are actually free from oppression. So another, just and the fact that she was willing to tolerate, you know, that those years of house arrest. And, you know, really, it is amazing the lengths that people will go in the world to silence people who actually are speaking for other people's freedom. So, you know, we look at the American elections at the moment and the noise and the clamour and the shouting and roaring that's going on out there. And really the voice, people say, of, you know, perhaps I like to hear Bernie Sanders. It's like it's been drowned out because the media want all the claptrap that's going on about the other. And anyway, that's just so I wouldn't spend an evening with either of the runners. But certainly, no, Barack Obama, actually. I had a lot of time for Barack Obama. I would like to actually spend an evening with him. Yes, definitely. That's another my third person.
So of the three front runners for the elections, the one, Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, who would be your favorite as president of the free world?
Well, I'm not sure my favorite as president. Certainly, personally, I would like to see a woman president. Now, Hillary, you know, I'm not sure. I don't know her. I've never spent an evening with her, so I don't actually know anything really about her. But I would like to see a woman president. I think women bring something else to the table. And we've had a lot of, you know, men, you know, running countries and, you know, running wars and running stuff. And, you know, I'd like to give the opportunity to a woman to be the leader of the most powerful country in the Western world and really see what would come out of that.
But realistically, is Angela Merkel not pretty much up there already? Because Germany would be pretty much on a par with the US. Maybe not in how much they're prepared to talk about how they're the leaders of the free world, but Germany are one of the richest countries in the world.
Absolutely. And if you can see, what I see is happening now is that Angela Merkel did actually recognize what's happening in, you know, with the refugees. She did, you know, offer to open the doors for Germany, and something just that just wasn't acceptable. So now she is really suffering. So, you know, was she somebody else who was standing a voice for, you know, that these people may find some relief from the suffering that they're having in Syria? And who were the powers that be that said no? So now the tide has turned against her. And so it's almost like, is the world ready for women leaders and what they bring and the level of perhaps compassion or like what, you know, what they bring? Like, we don't know. We don't have enough women leaders yet. So we don't quite know what they bring to the world.
In terms of your own personal life, one of your hobbies is obviously, I know you've talked about getting out on a bike. You did it in Cambodia. You've done it in Ireland because I've been on the road with you at various points along the way. But you're a big fan of just getting lost in the mountains. Not lost necessarily, but just spending time in mountains.
Well, actually, I quite like getting lost in the mountains as well. And if I tell you the first time I got lost in the mountains, so I was on a summer job and I was working in a place in southern Germany called Oberstdorf. And my friend was in a hut at the top of the mountain. And I was wondering if I could go actually and, you know, visit her. So we didn't have, my German wasn't very good and their English wasn't really very good. But anyway, we did discover that if I left at 4:30 in the morning on a particular day and walk with the whole village and about 3,000 cows, we got to the plane at 12 o'clock and then they pointed and they said, follow that track. And I thought, okay. So I followed the track up through the Alps and I passed the snow line at about 7 o'clock. And I arrived at my destination about 10 o'clock that night and I had just kept walking and I was completely and utterly alone on the Alps. And I sang The Sound of Music and The Hills Are Alive. And I thought it was just the most amazing, liberating experience of my entire life.
But probably the craziest, and in some respects, I say this in the nicest possible way, one of the stupidest things to do. Into the Alps on your own, no support team. Did you have any way of people knowing where you were?
Absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. I completely, as I say, you know, they didn't think it was a problem. They said, follow the path. And they showed me the path, and it looked like a path. Well, no, there wasn't. There was only snow at the when I came to the snow line. But look, it was probably the start of my adventures. I did actually have a previous adventure in the Gaeltacht, but we won't go there.
Oh, no, I think we need to go there.
No, we won't go there. And but I think it was just the excitement. Yeah, it was just the excitement of actually maybe breaking the rules and just, you know, like, what's there to be afraid of, really? I'm pretty fearless.
Death.
You know, so what? Death, we're going to die anyway. I'm not, personally, I'm not necessarily afraid of dying. It wasn't one of my things. I don't want to die. I love my life. I really want to do way more, and there's lots more that I can do, but I'm not actually afraid of it. So, anyway, that was, and I suppose probably because I have done so much in my life and I have not died yet. So I don't think I'm going to die through something of my own making. And
tell me a little bit about Cambodia, and because your face lights up whenever you talk about it. So the cycle you did, the 350 kilometers on a bike, what was that for?
That was for, I have a young friend and he runs a school, and it was just his dream to run a school. So he has a school for orphans. He was an orphan. And he didn't have much education. And I met him when I was holidaying in Cambodia. And we exchanged emails over time. And anyway, over time, he eventually, with a little bit of support and encouragement from me, he did actually get onto the path where he could actually run a school for himself. So he has his school. He looks after poor orphan children. He is really good actually on the internet now, because he manages to get anybody who's traveling, they can actually join and they can come to a school and they can teach the children anything. Just come along, teach the children, and he's really grateful for anything. And he doesn't have any resources. And when he did it, he just said that the children were the human resources for Cambodia. And he really is really encouraging children just to, you know, that, I mean, they have such a sad and tragic history. And so in 1975, when I was doing my intercert, he was an 8-year-old boy, orphaned, you know, running away from everybody who was, you know, had killed his entire family. So he didn't have anybody until, you know, the monks maybe took him in and sort of educated him a little bit, but not a huge amount. And then, you know, when he asked me just to exchange emails, I never realized that just by answering that email, that would have opened up such a world for him. But he is just an amazing man. So for the last 10 years, you know, he just has been improving himself and just really trying to do as much as he possibly can so that the other orphan children don't, you know, will actually have what he didn't have, which is access to education.
In terms of funding, how does he keep a project like that alive in a country like Cambodia?
I have no idea. But he's fairly resourceful. He's just resourceful. He just asks people for help. And they help him.
I think that's key. And I think that for me was one of the highlights of my trip, was I didn't even necessarily have to ask for help. I just had to be prepared to accept it. And the doors that were opened and the mouths that were fed, my mouth that was fed usually, along the way was phenomenal. The amount of support I got from strangers, 99% of the support I got was from people I hadn't met before. I literally knew them 5 minutes. And they just opened their homes, opened their fridges, and in some places they didn't even have a fridge to keep the food they were serving to me.
Mm-hmm.
It was fantastic. And I love that people who really go out of their way to try and help others means a lot to me. That's why I love what you do with the book. It's fantastic, the diary. As I said, I think I gave 8 or 9 of them as Christmas presents this year.
Good man, Breffni. Keep up the good work.
And I know they'll be in my family's stockings at Christmas time next year as well. Yeah. So it's a huge, huge testament to you. We do finish the show every week with the same question. Now, I know you're a regular listener to the podcast, so you know what the question is ahead of time. By the face you're making at me now, you're like, I listened to the start of the podcast, but not the whole thing. Here's where that would have paid a benefit. The question is quite simply, what can the listeners of the podcast do for Eileen Forreston? If you had one question to ask, what would you ask them to do for you?
I would ask them to go on the CHAB website, CHAB, and donate or sponsor Kim's school in Cambodia.
If Thank you very much. That's a fantastic. My favorite responses to that question are when it's not actually for you, that it's actually something that the listener benefits from. So you pass that test with flying colors. Eileen Forrestal, it's been an absolute pleasure to have your company this week. Thank you very much for coming to have a chat with us. And best of luck with the Get Up and Go Diary and everything else you do in the future.
Well, thanks, Breffni. It's been a wonderful experience. This is my very first podcast. And thank you.